From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. The Washington Liquor Control Board has new draft rules for the state's new marijuana industry. Four public hearings on the proposed rules will be held across the state between August 6th and 8th. The rules are scheduled to take effect on September 16th. Helping to guide the process to legalization is UCLA professor Mark Kleiman. The state hired him to lead a consulting team in the process. Mark Kleiman is the co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everybody Needs to Know. In the past, Kleiman argued that states cannot legalize marijuana. Federal officials will never stand for it. When we spoke Wednesday, I asked his current thinking on that.
What's true is that no state can make something legal federally. So the Liquor Board is in the process of writing regulations that will allow people to apply for and receive licenses to commit federal felonies. So this will only be a quasi-legal market, and that's going to have lots of effects down the line. I think compared to the California proposition, which I was criticizing back in 2010, I-502 is much more carefully drafted I think a much better candidate for federal tolerance. And there's been some indication from the White House that they're inclined in that direction. But we have not gotten anything yet from the Justice Department, and that's an ongoing problem.
We know there's two concerns of the federal government. One, legalized pot for adults not lead to more pot smoking by kids. Second, that legalized pot in one state not end up in other states. Are those two concerns addressed by these regulations?
Well, there's been a lot of attention to the diversion problem. Ironically, I-502 could result in less exports of cannabis from Washington to other states. Washington is currently a substantial producer for export. There are both Canadian and Mexican groups growing cannabis in Washington for shipment out of state. And that also, of course, supplies a lot of the Washington's own market. If we can migrate the production for the Washington market into a tax and regulated system, that may cut back on some of the infrastructure that supports the export trade. I would be very surprised if substantial amounts of material leaked from the tax and regulated market. Of course, material will get to kids, and the only question is how much you can restrict that. Distinguish, though, between replacing current illicit supply to adolescents with supply that's diverted from the legal market, right? So how do adolescents get liquor? They get it from their parents' liquor cabinet or from the wino outside the liquor store who goes in and buys them a six-pack. That's actually better than they're buying moonshine because at least it's a product that's of known purity and safety. Given that adolescents in Washington State are going to continue to use cannabis, I don't think it's a particularly bad thing if they get cannabis that was originally through the legal system. What you're worried about is a price decrease that would lead to more consumption by adolescents or increased availability. I think in the first year, we've got the opposite problem, whether the licit market is going to be able to compete on price with the illicit market and the medical market.
Yeah, the price question is a big one. How is Washington State going to ensure that the price is right on legal marijuana, not so high that the illegal market continues? And how does it avoid that?
Well, the board, has been aware in its rule-setting process of the need to be cautious about imposing costs on the legal industry that the illegal industries won't bear. Taxation, of course, is a major factor. The taxation structure in the law is not, I think, the ideal one. You'd like taxes to rise as the pre-tax price falls to maintain an appropriate retail price of something like the current illicit market price. Instead, under the existing system, as the market price falls, the tax falls with it because the tax is a fraction of the market price. So I think the tax is going to start out too high and wind up too low. And I think the legislature may be called on to think about a different tax structure.
Now, the state law, as I understand it, expressly prohibits people from growing their own marijuana. Is that the best public policy?
In a world where cannabis was legal nationally, I would argue for allowing people to grow their own. In fact, I'd at least think about forbidding any commercial growing. Right? So one public policy approach for cannabis would be, look, it's a weed. Go ahead and grow it and smoke it. But nobody's going to get rich off somebody else's drug problem. That's not really feasible while it remains illegal federally Because if you give people permission to grow at home, untaxed, unlicensed, unregulated, very hard to keep them from growing at home and then exporting it. That is, they say there would be big businesses arising simply by aggregating homegrown production. So I think that there are lots of things, including a state monopoly distribution system, that would be good ideas that are not feasible as long as the federal law is what it is.
I'm speaking with Mark Kleiman. He's the UCLA professor who heads the consulting group that's consulting with the state of Washington about how to roll out these regulations on growing, processing, and sales of legal marijuana as Washingtonians have voted on. Now, one of the things not originally considered was marijuana concentrates such as hash oil. But this week, the Liquor Control Board allowed for that to be part of legal sales. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, here's the problem. The law doesn't allow concentrates. The law allows infused products. So it's certainly legal to make a concentrate like hash oil and infuse it into, say, orange juice, right? So if I have a gallon of orange juice and put a drop of hash oil in it, I have a marijuana-infused product. What if I take a gallon of hash oil and put a drop of orange juice in it? At what point does hash oil with a little orange juice added become marijuana-infused orange juice? There's no natural break. And so I think the board basically gave into the inevitable, particularly since, remember, to start with, we're going to be fighting the illicit market and the medical market, both of which offer concentrates. And so a ban on concentrates in the I-502 market would simply send those consumers back into the two markets that we're competing with.
There's not a cap, as I understand it, on the number of stores that one person or company could own, the number of stores selling legal marijuana. Some are arguing that there should be. What do you think about that?
I think there are arguments on both sides. I'm actually more concerned about brands than I am about chain ownership, particularly cross-state brands. I guess if you'd awakened me in the middle of the night and said, should we have a limit on how many stores somebody could own, I would have said, yeah, probably. I don't think that's a first-order problem. There may be a bigger problem in concentration of production.
Well, and in fact, there is one would-be potrepreneur who wants to build a national marijuana brand, maybe the Marlboro of reefer. That's something you've criticized strongly. Why do you think that could be a problem?
Well, there's two issues. I think that while the stuff remains illegal under federal law, announcing that you're going to run a national brand is setting yourself up for a prison cell. From the point of view of the state, having somebody here doing that probably makes it harder for the federal government to acquiesce in the operation of the I-502 market. The broader issue is that if you have national branding, you're going to have national marketing. And that gets us back to the problem of increased use by juveniles and increased heavy use. The problem with any legal cannabis business, just like any legal alcohol business, is that it's financially dependent on people who are chemically dependent. Most of the consumption will be by people who use too much. And therefore, the marketing effort will be directed at them. So it seems to me that keeping the marketing effort down is an objective. In a sane world, you'd simply ban marketing. But the Supreme Court, I think, incorrectly, has interpreted the Constitution as saying that although a state could make a product illegal, forbid its sale, criminalize its sale, it can't make it legal and then forbid its marketing, which seems to me like an obvious middle step between full legalization and prohibition. But the court has ruled that once you allow something to be sold, then people have free speech rights about the way they want to sell it, so that you can have marketing geniuses getting rich off encouraging more 15-year-olds to become stoners. That just seems like a very bad idea. But until we get a new Supreme Court, it means that the state is somewhat limited. On the other hand, the fact that there's a federal law could actually be a plus here, because doing a heavy marketing campaign might be one good way to attract federal law enforcement attention. Again, in an ideal world, the state and the federal government would make an agreement, which is permitted by the Controlled Substances Act, on cooperative efforts with respect to cannabis. And one thing that the state could do is say, well, look, we can't ban marketing because of what the Supreme Court's done, but we can draw the attention of federal enforcement authorities, anybody doing marketing. And since, again, they're committing crimes under federal law, the federal government could shut them down.
Mark Kleiman is my guest. He's the co-author of Marijuana Legalization, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's a UCLA professor, and he's the head of a consulting group that's working with the state of Washington on how to implement these marijuana laws. You mentioned a little bit earlier, Mark, that the taxation in this law is not ideal. Are there other parts of how this is rolling out that, where the state's not really taking your advice on what the best practices should be?
The state did not ask for our advice about what to do. They asked for information about things like the size of the market and analysis of the pros and cons of different steps they could take. But when I'm not being a consultant to the state of Washington, I am also an independent academic thinking about marijuana policy. And in that hat, I have lots of opinions. I wouldn't have written I-502 the way it was written. I probably would have, in the long run, had a production limit, though I agreed to want one in the short run. I probably would have denominated that in units of THC rather than dry weight of cannabis or square footage. I think the main thing I'm concerned about right now is that the law, and this is not the board's province, this is for the governor and the legislature. The law allocates money to the board to administer the system. It allocates money to prevention and treatment efforts. It allocates money to education. It allocates no money to local law enforcement. And yet, for a taxed and regulated market to exist, the untaxed and unregulated illegal market has to be driven down, which means you need active local law enforcement going after illegal growers and illegal dealers. And that will be a net revenue gain for the state, since every customer you drive from the illicit market to the licit market means an increase in tax returns. It will also serve the original purpose of the initiative, which is to take money out of criminal hands and put it in the hands of honest business people and the state. So it seems to me, if I were running the state, I would want aggressive law enforcement. And that movement isn't yet happening.
The final decisions about these regulations on growing, processing, and selling marijuana won't be out until August. What are the biggest undecided issues that will affect these applications? What's still out there to be decided?
I don't think there's anything left undecided that will be crucial to the application process other than the allocation of stores, right? The board has decided to limit the number of retail outlets. And they've got to decide how to break that down first by county and then by locality. And some of that work remains to be done. But it's important to note, it's crucial to note, that these are not the final rules. This is the final edition of the first set of rules.
Right.
There will be additional rules issued before the market starts. For example, the whole labeling set, the set of labeling requirements is still to be determined. The vendor training rules are still to be determined. The development of child-resistant and child-aversive packaging is still to be determined. But even once the industry is in operation, there will be more rules coming. I think eventually there'll have to be a production cap. Not now, but when the tracking system says that people are now planning to grow twice as much as we think the retail stores can sell, then there needs to be a brake put on that. And the encouraging thing about this process is that Rick Garza, the new director of the board, has been very clear that they're appropriately focused right now on what he calls day one, getting the regulations out, getting the license applications in, issuing licenses, getting the system going. But they're aware that they're going to have to focus from then on monitoring and mid-course correction. This is going to be a learning process.
You've spoken to this a bit, but what are the big known unknowns when it comes to how this regulatory system might play out in the real world?
Big unknowns. How the federal government's going to react, whether that's going to be different across the two judicial districts, what the current size is of the illicit market, and how that will change, what the current size of the medical market and how that will change, what the preferences are going to be of new consumers as distinct from the existing consumer base and how many of them they're going to be, what happens to production costs as people move into licit at the state level operation and learn about how to do that. I mean, how fast that's going to fall, what the consequence is with respect to cannabis consumption. Big, big, big unknown. What the impact is of legal marijuana on the consumption of other dangerous drugs, starting with alcohol. We don't know whether legal cannabis is going to be more heavy drinking or less heavy drinking, more meth use or less meth use. Those are crucial questions. They're to some extent malleable to policies. So the rule, for example, that you can't have liquor and cannabis sold on the same premises seems to me like an excellent idea. But I think we need to think hard about how to discourage combination use.
Mark, the name of the corporation that you're consulting with the state with is Botec Analysis, which stands for back of the envelope calculations. I should think that with your close work with the state on this, you're getting much more detail. You might be learning as much as you're helping the state learn.
We're learning a great deal. It's been an infinitely fascinating project. And I should say that we specialize in quick and dirty calculations, but our partner, the RAND Corporation, does the calculations right. So those are the numbers that RAND is providing. There are known numbers with known errors of estimate. Our general view is that validity trumps precision. And it's more important to ask the right question than to get an answer to three decimal places.
How long is your contract for?
The contract is open, but as of right now, we have virtually completed all of our tests. We should hand in our final report sometime in mid-July, and the budget that the legislature gave the board didn't allow for any additional work by us. So we are in the process of holding our tents.
Are you getting inquiries from other states that might be considering legalized marijuana?
Not yet.
And finally, you've been asked to advise the state on things. Isn't it time to rename the Liquor Control Board that's overseeing this? Do you have any thoughts on what it might be better called?
Hadn't thought about that. It could be called the Intoxicant Control Board. I think it's very important to remind to keep people thinking about cannabis as a drug. And it would be wonderful if we could get people to think about alcohol as a drug. You know, look, the cannabis is what's moving, so that's what people are paying attention to. The overwhelming bulk of the drug abuse problem, including the drug abuse problem by minors, is alcohol. And so I think it's crucial to think at every stage about what the impact is of the board's actions on the total drug abuse problem. And a striking difference between the way they're approaching cannabis and the way any liquor control authority in this country approaches alcohol is they're worrying about how many kids are going to get access. They're worrying about the price. They're worrying about developing new drug abusers. Because the first time a kid wraps his car around a tree stoned, people are going to say, well, why didn't the liquor board prevent that? Notice that people don't blame the liquor board for drunk driving accidents. People don't blame the liquor board if there's a drunken party by high school students. In the alcohol domain, their job as the public sees it and as the political environment sees it is maintaining an orderly sales system that doesn't, for example, sell to minors. Controlling alcohol abuse is not really at the top of their list. They're not worrying about how to keep the price of alcohol high to prevent alcohol abuse. I think that's less than they should be asked to do about alcohol. But they're being asked to do that about cannabis. It'll be interesting to see how much of the thinking that goes into cannabis regulation will eventually bleed over into liquor regulation. But let's never forget that the drug that does the most damage to this country is the one that we legalized.
Mark, our reporter, Amy Radel, who's covering this, is with me in the studio. She's been listening in, and she's got a question, some questions for you, too.
Wonderful.
I just wanted to follow up on a couple of things. When you gave that example with the orange juice, and the extracts, do they have to have I saw something in the Seattle Times about a drop of olive oil. Is there a technicality for them to sell the extracts where they have to have a drop of something else in the extract? Is that how they are making that work under the regulations?
Well, here's the problem. The law, right, this is something the board doesn't control. The law allows marijuana-infused products. It doesn't explicitly allow concentrates. So the board sort of read the law and said, we can't allow the sale of concentrates. But somebody pointed out, but how about the infusion of a lot of marijuana into a little bit of olive oil, for example? And again, there doesn't seem to be any provision where they could forbid that. So they're going to go to the legislature for clarification in January. Remember, nothing's going to be going across the counter till at least March. So there's still time to get this fixed.
And does the legislature have to take some kind of action for them to sell the extracts, or could they still do it under this definition that you're talking about?
Well, again, I mean, as far as I can tell, they can't forbid selling, 1% olive oil and 99% hash oil, because that's infused.
Right.
So, yes, it'll be useful for the legislature. I think simply to recognize reality. Concentrates are an important part of the medical market. If we forbid concentrates in the I-5 stores, we're simply driving people out of those stores. I'd much rather have an aggressive labeling and consumer information process to make people aware of the potential risks of concentrates rather than simply have a blanket ban.
Some of the prevention groups said they shouldn't be allowed to sell marijuana-infused products that will be so appealing to children, like lollipops and stuff like that. I don't see anything. I'm still looking at the new regs. Do you know if they took any action on that? Do you think they should restrict the types of infused products or no?
I think there's a serious issue about there's two levels of appealing to kids, right? One is, are you going to have products in the store that kids are going to ask their older friends to buy for them? The other problem is, when the product is sitting at home, is the four-year-old going to think it's a fun thing to eat? And that's so there are going to be rules about child-resistant packaging. People say child-proof, and of course there's no such thing. I think not enough attention has been paid yet to child-aversive packaging. Right, so for a while ago, the poison control people invented a face that looked like somebody had eaten something disgusting. That was the Mr. Yuck face, and put it on all sorts of household cleaners, again to discourage the children from consuming them. Mm-hmm. I think we need something equivalent in the cannabis edibles area.
That's UCLA professor Mark Kleiman. He's a consultant to Washington State and co-author of Marijuana Legalization: What Everyone Needs to Know. From KUOW, I'm Ross Reynolds.